Well, good morning. And on the basis of Nigel's welcome, I realise that during the last 18 months, while I was thinking, you know, I might not ever be back here, that actually turned out to be your hope. Anyway, here we are. So, the last time I was here, and I'm sure the trauma is indelibly etched on your memories. We looked at Numbers chapter 5. So we're in chapter 6 this morning. And we're going to take it in sections. So to start with, I'm going to read the first 8 verses. And we'll look at those and then we'll move our way through the chapter. So Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 to 8 to begin with. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of dedication to the Lord as a Nazarite, they must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, and must not drink vinegar made from wine or other fermented drink. They must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. As long as they remain under the Nazarite vow, they must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seed or skins. During the entire period of their Nazarite vow, no razor may be used on their head. They must be holy until the period of their dedication to the Lord is over. They must let their hair grow long. Throughout the period of their dedication to the Lord, the Nazarite must not go near a dead body. Even if their own mother or father or brother or sister dies, they must not make themselves ceremonially unclean on account of them, because the symbol of their dedication to God is on their head. Throughout the period of their dedication, they are consecrated to the Lord." Now, consecrated is not a word we hear very often today. I spent a little time doing some English teaching, and there's not a day that passes without someone asking me, "What does that word mean?" Or, "What does this sentence mean?" And it's perhaps something that they have come across in a worksheet, or they've heard someone say, and I have never to date been asked what consecrated means. And I suspect it'll be a while before that happens. It's an old-fashioned word, not much use today, and it's a bit of an old-fashioned concept as well. A neighbour of mine died a couple of months ago, and a few weeks later I met one of her sons coming out of the house carrying some boxes, and they contained wedding presents that had been given to his parents over 50 years ago. Cutlery, cups, saucers, that sort of thing. And he was telling me they were all in their original packaging. Not one of them had ever been used once during that time. I guess originally the idea was that they would be kept for special occasions. It was just that no occasion turned out to be special enough. And the idea of consecration that we read about in Numbers 6 does carry that idea of being kept apart for special uses, but it does absolutely not mean you sitting around on a shelf or in a cupboard doing nothing more than looking nice, but ending up being of no use at all. It's much more about the idea of being set apart, yes, but for God's use. People choosing to set themselves apart in a special way for a specific period of time. And the vow of consecration was to be a mirror for the people of God. They were, after all, to be a consecrated people. This is the story of the Old Testament up to this point. We see in Genesis 3 that sin has ruined God's creation. In Exodus, we find him redeeming a people, delivering them from slavery. In Leviticus, we see how they are to live, different to the other nations, how they are to live as his consecrated people, in contrast to the way the other people around them would live. And then we come to Numbers, and here we find Israel as a pilgrim people, on their way to the promised land. In fact, in these early chapters of Numbers, they are getting ready for that journey. But they are never to forget that they remain a consecrated people, a holy people. Throughout their journey, God will live amongst them in the tabernacle, and they are to be a people dedicated to him. So it's important that we see this in a positive context, although there were things to abstain from. Being a Nazarite was to be constructive and constructive and encouraging thing to others. But for the vow taker, there were things to be abstained from. The very word abstaining also comes from the idea of separating. Because they were setting themselves apart, setting themselves aside for a special purpose, there were things they needed to abstain from in order to do so. Not unlike a marriage. There's a positive of two people committing themselves to each other. That's the positive side. But there's also the negative that flows from that automatically, forsaking all others. So the Nazarite was a man or a woman whose vow was temporary, for the most part, a personal commitment to avoid three things. He or she would abstain from grapes and alcoholic beverages, let his hair grow and not cut it, and stay away from dead bodies. And the prohibitions were pretty extreme in their extent. It's not hard to understand why there might be a ban on alcohol. If you're doing something that is important, that needs concentration, it's better not to have a blurred mind. But no vinegar on your chips, no grape juice at breakfast, no raisins as a healthy alternative to chocolate. It's a bit rigorous. And there's a lot of speculation about why grapes were chosen. There's nothing immoral about grapes in themselves, of course, but since wine was the primary symbol of joy in the ancient world, perhaps they were chosen to represent earthly pleasures. Not that there's anything wrong with those either. God has given us lots of things to enjoy within his providential framework. So here was a striking voluntary commitment to forgo life's normal pleasures. In any event, these vows were rigorous. And not just rigorous, but also conspicuous. Nazarites were not simply to let their hair grow, they were to grow it long, without cutting it at all, throughout the length of their vow. And during the past 18 months, you could have been forgiven that lots of people had taken this Nazarite vow. So when the people saw the Nazarites around the camp, and you couldn't really have missed them, it was a reminder to the whole people of their own consecration to God. Finally, the Nazarites were not simply to stay away from corpses in general, as all Israelites were required to do. Again, here, the requirements were much more rigorous. Death is the penalty of sin, so dead bodies were a reminder of sin and its consequences. Yet in normal life, there were permitted exemptions to this general rule of keeping away from dead bodies. Someone had to prepare the bodies of the dead for burial, and normally this would be the task of a close relative. But Nazarites had to stay away even from the bodies of their very closest family members. So these were not random commitments. In fact, each restriction applied to Israel's priests, albeit in a less extreme way. Priests were required to abstain from alcohol, but only while on duty. They also had to be careful with their hair, and they were forbidden to shave it. The high priest in particular was not allowed to dishevel his hair as a sign of mourning. And generally they were to avoid contact with dead bodies because such contact with the realm of death made a person unclean. And the high priest, like the Nazarite, had particular obligations. He could not come into contact with a corpse, even to mourn his own mother or father. And when we see these parallels, we understand that the Nazarite was a kind of temporary lay priest, someone who for a period of time lived according to the special levels of ritual purity demanded of those whose lives were constantly lived in the Lord's presence. Now, occasionally in the Old Testament, we come across someone, a Nazarite, who was set apart at birth and for life. Samson, for example, although he's not much of an example. In fact, a less dedicated Nazarite than Samson would be hard to imagine. We're told of his desire to marry a Philistine woman. Far from keeping himself separate from the uncircumcised enemies of the Lord, he wants to climb into bed with one. On his way to marry her, Samson sees a lion's corpse where bees had made their nest. Of course, as a Nazarite, he should have stayed well clear, not Samson. Motivated more by his appetite than his calling, he goes over and scoops some honey out of the dead body. When he arrives at the home of his future in-laws, Samson celebrates with a feast. The Hebrew word for feast comes from the verb to drink. So it's unlikely Samson at this party was a designated driver sitting quietly in the corner, nursing his Diet Coke while everyone else partied. So there we go, two vows broken, one to go. Later, of course, after a bit of nagging, he reveals to Delilah the source of his strength, and she promptly shaves his head while he sleeps. And there goes number three. Instead of being a mirror to Israel of who they ought to be, he was showing them who they really were, a people untrue in every area of life to their calling to be holy. Another more promising example is the prophet Samuel, again another lifelong Nazarite. He was born at a time of great spiritual decline in Israel. The priests of the day, Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, were bringing religion into disrepute by running the temple for their own personal profit and by sleeping with the women who served there. Samuel's devotion to the Lord stood in constant contrast to their corruption. Yet even Samuel's life was tainted by sin, not least by indulging his own wicked sons as they abused their positions of power. One of the striking features of this chapter is that it doesn't actually tell us why people or how people should take the Nazarite oath. Instead, once it reminds us of the nature of the vow, its attention turns immediately to two issues. And the first is, what happens if this vow is inadvertently broken? And we're going to read the next few verses, verses 9 to 12, that deal with that. So verses 9 to 12. If someone dies suddenly in the Nazarite's presence, thus defiling the hair that symbolizes their dedication, they must shave their head on the seventh day, the day of their cleansing. Then on the eighth day, they must bring two doves or two young pigeons to the priest at the entrance to the tent of meeting. The priest is to offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering to make atonement for the Nazarite, because they sinned by being in the presence of the dead body. That same day they are to consecrate their head again. They must rededicate themselves to the Lord for the same period of dedication and must bring a day-old male lamb as a guilt offering. The previous days do not count because they became defiled during their period of dedication. So suppose you, as a Nazarite, were quietly minding your own business when someone dropped dead in your presence. What should you do? It wasn't your fault that the vow to keep away from corpses was broken, but it was broken. Your consecration to the Lord had been defiled, and even such an inadvertent sin required substantive atonement with the shedding of blood and the reshaving of your head. A few days ago, I had coffee with a guy I used to work with, and he was telling me about his parents, who are both 91 and live in the north of England. During lockdown, his mother fell and broke her left arm, and she had just fully recovered when she fell again and broke her right arm. And she just fully recovered from that when she fell again and broke both arms. Unbelievable. No previous period of healing counted when the next break came. The healing process had to start right from the beginning again. And so it was for the Nazarite. Following a broken vow, the whole thing had to start from the very beginning. Now, particularly for vows broken unintentionally, this seems pretty harsh. But the vow had to be completed exactly as promised. The message is clear. Sin, even of the unintentional variety, requires payment in blood, and nothing short of perfect fulfillment of what was promised is sufficient. God is a holy God whose standards are, in the end, even with our best efforts, impossible to meet. So there's the inadvertent breaking of the vow, and then the second issue that the chapter really concentrates on is the completion of the vow. What happens at that stage? And we're reading verses 13 to 21 for that. Now this is the law of the Nazarite. When the period of their dedication is over, they are to be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. There they are to present their offerings to the Lord, a year old male lamb without defect for a burnt offering, a year old ewe lamb without defect for a sin offering, a ram without defect for a fellowship offering, together with their grain offerings and drink offerings, and a basket of bread made with the finest flour and without yeast, thick loaves with olive oil mixed in, and thin loaves brushed with olive oil. The priest is to present all these before the Lord and make the sin offering and the burnt offering. He is to present the basket of unleavened bread and is to sacrifice the ram as a fellowship offering to the Lord, together with its grain offering and drink offering. Then at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the Nazarite must shave off the hair that symbolizes their dedication. They are to take the hair and put it into the fire that is under the sacrifice of the fellowship offering. After the Nazarite has shaved off the hair that symbolizes their dedication, the priest is to place in their hands a boiled shoulder of the ram and one thick loaf and one thin loaf from the basket, both made without yeast. The priest shall then wave these before the Lord as a wave offering. They are holy and belong to the priest, together with the breast that was waved and the thigh that was presented. After that, the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite who vows offerings to the Lord in accordance with their dedication, in addition to whatever else they can afford. They must fulfill the vows they have made according to the law of the Nazarite. So, you finally get through the period of the vow, even with a couple of restarts. Surely, if ever there was a justification for a sacrifice-free celebration, this would be it. But no, a person couldn't just walk away from his life of complete devotion to God and return to ordinary life without something else happening. He had to offer an assortment of offerings, covering all the basic kinds of sacrifice. At the end of his vow, he had to complete all the covenant obligations in miniature, a whole range of burnt offerings which symbolize total consecration and general atonement for sin, a grain offering or tribute offering as a mark of submission to the Lord, a sin offering symbolizing the forgiveness that was required for particular sins. There were also the offerings of unleavened bread because leaven represents change and decay and therefore sin, and the associated drink offerings. Finally, as a climax, the Nazarite would offer a fellowship offering, symbolizing communion with God around a common table. The fellowship offering was a symbolic meal with God. Part was offered on the altar along with the Nazarite's hair, which had finally been shaved off, symbolizing his life offered up to God. Meanwhile, the remainder was consumed by the worshipper and his family. The end of the vow was a celebration of joy, of life in God's presence, and after that, he returned to his normal life. He was now free from his vow and was once again able to drink wine, cut his hair. So, what's the point of this passage? A Nazarite recruitment campaign. I imagine any advertising company producing this sort of campaign to recruit Nazarites would soon find itself with one less client. Surely the purpose of the very existence of the whole idea of the Nazarite vow shows us the inability of the Old Testament people of God to meet God's standards of perfect holiness. Nazarites took a vow of special holiness for a limited time, for the most part. Even then, some were unable to complete it without further sacrifices and starting over again. Almost all of those who did take the vow eventually went back to normal life. And even those who completed it without any setbacks and at the completion of the vow to make a full range of sacrifices. Could the message be any clearer? Even our very best efforts aren't good enough. And the same is true of us. If you're like me, the truth is that we don't even keep the resolutions we make to the Lord to serve him. Never mind those we ought to be making. Our sins and broken promises to God are not merely inadvertent. They are often deliberate and repeated. We do and say things that we ought not to do and say, and we fail to do and say things that we ought to. Even if we turn over a new leaf for a while, sooner or later we fail. A life of wholehearted, unfaltering giving up of things that might legitimately be ours for the sake of the kingdom. A life of unfailing, willingly handing over to God's hands full control of our lives. A lifetime of always eagerly separating ourselves from the realm of sin of death. No chance. Is it any wonder that John writes in one of his letters, if we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. Yet, in light of all of this, look at the final verses of this chapter, 22 to 25. The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and to be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. So they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them. Here is an amazing blessing for God's people. But given the message of this chapter, the nagging question we're left with is, and it's the great tension that runs through the Old Testament, how secure is the blessing? How can people have a relationship with God and all its entailing blessings given their sin? How secure is this blessing if even those who give themselves fully to his service and keep their vows still need to offer sacrifices? How would it be possible for Israel to journey through the wilderness to the promised land with God, without God having to leave them en route? And how will we journey through life without him having to leave us too? What Israel needed and what we needed is someone who would come and permanently and finally and perfectly, without any restarts permitted, fulfill the role of the Nazarite on their behalf. The answer to this need is certainly not Samson and not even Samuel. Neither were able to bring about lasting rest and peace for God's people. For that, we need to turn from the consecrated Nazarite to the consecrated Messiah. Do you want to see someone who set aside the joy and comfort that might all otherwise legitimately have been his? Look at Jesus, who left the glories of heaven and came down to live amongst us. Do you want to see someone who gave up complete control of his own life, handing it over fully to his heavenly Father? Look at Jesus, facing the reality of the cross, crying, not my will, but yours. Do you want to see someone separated from sin and death? Look at Jesus, whose life of perfection was such that he was completely without blemish or flaw. He had no sin, deliberate or involuntary, that needed to be atoned for. He needed no sin offering or guilt offering to be made on his behalf in order to enter the presence of his heavenly Father. He was consecrated to God from birth, not by outward symbols, but by the inner reality of a holiness that pervaded every aspect of his life. He was not a Nazarite in the formal sense. He not only turned water into wine, but drank it himself. As far as we know, he had haircuts, and he definitely touched dead bodies. The very things that would be a breach of a Nazarite's vow or make anyone else unclean as a result of contact with them, skin diseases, bodily discharges, dead bodies, when Jesus made contact with them, he was not defiled. Rather, the reverse was true. Their contact with him brought healing, cleaning, resurrection from the dead. For Jesus himself, with the spotless atonement offering, whose blood enables us to draw near to the presence of the Holy God and experience his blessing, he gave his life to enable us to share God's feast. If Israel was supposed to be a reminder of their own need to be holy every time they saw a Nazarite walking in their midst, how much more should we be convicted of our own need to be holy every time we contemplate the commitment of Jesus? Sometimes the Christian life feels like a game of snakes and ladders. We throw the dice, we make some progress, maybe even scale a ladder or two on the way, having made a particular effort in some special area of service or with someone. But before we know it, we've slid down a snake. And it can seem to be a succession of resolutions that we inevitably end up failing to keep. And yet Paul says in 2 Corinthians 6 this, we are the temple of the living God. Not God living in a tabernacle amongst his people, but living in us. We are the temple of the living God. Think how the translators didn't choose to translate this verse. They didn't choose a future tense. We will become the temple of the living God. They didn't even choose a continuous tense. We are becoming the temple of the living God. No, they chose what I've discovered over the last couple of years is the present tense. And it is not, as its name suggests, used to talk about things that are happening now. The present tense is used to talk about things that are true. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. The earth revolves around the sun. Football is boring. See, that last one is not a that is not a fact, of course, because there are words missing in that sentence that are implied, both by me and you understand that it really means, I think football is boring, or in my opinion, football is boring. But there are no words missing from 2 Corinthians 6 that we need to imply. It's a straightforward statement of the truth. We are the temple of the living God. It's not something that happens on our Christian journey. Our Christian journey starts with that truth. That is not the goal of our Christian journey. It is the beginning. Undeserved, unmerited, Jesus gives to us his perfect score. And we never lose it. We never have to start all over again. No more sacrifices are required. So, at the start of the next chapter, chapter 7 of 2 Corinthians, Paul writes this. Therefore, since we have these promises, dear friends, let us purify ourselves from everything that contaminates the body and spirit, perfecting holiness out of reverence to God. He is talking about the life of love for God and grateful service we are to live in light of these truths. What might such a life look like in practice? Well, what about taking the three areas that feature in the Nazarite vow? One, what are we clinging to for our security or fulfillment or pleasure? What is there that we say we must have if we are to be happy here? A habit that we are unwilling to break, a pleasure that we are unwilling to forego, a dream we desperately want to see fulfilled. Possibly something that isn't even sinful in itself, like the grapes, but it has become more important to us than it ought to be. Or what about who is in control of each of our lives? The irony here is, of course, that we don't really have control of our own lives to begin with. We cannot even make our own hair grow. Just ask Lindsay. Sorry, Lindsay, that was gratuitously offensive of me. We like to maintain the illusion that we really do control our own lives. So when life takes an unwelcome turn or makes unwanted demands of us, we often go along kicking and screaming. That was not the way of the Nazarite, nor was it the way of Jesus. God has the right to direct our lives in whatever way he sees fit. Are we willing to be separated from the realm of sin and death? In his second letter, Peter appeals to his readers that in view of the prospect of the return of the Lord, they should make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. There is to be a difference between our lifestyles and those of the world around us. We should long to be separate from the spiritual death and corruption that surrounds us on every side. Think of the pioneer missionaries who left everything for the expectation of a short and painful life in the wilds of Africa. Or think of the martyrs who suffered in prison and tortured for the sake of the Christ, and those for whom, for the sake of Christ, they are being tortured and imprisoned today. And I contrast that, the sacrifice of those believers, offering themselves as living sacrifices, with my own self-protective attitudes. Who can doubt which of these two approaches is more in line with the gospel? One final thing. Like the Nazarite, whatever we may give up in this life, it is only a temporary loss. There is an end coming. There is a time ahead when all of the separation and tears and pain will be over, and we will sit down in the presence of the Lord for a great celebration feast that will never come to an end. All paid for by Jesus' perfect life and sacrifice at Calvary. And the promised blessings are sure because his time for giving things up is already over. Things that no eye has seen, or ear heard, or mind imagined, are the things God has prepared for those who love him. No one on that day will ever think that they gave up too much for God. On the contrary, Paul tells us that all our earthly trials and sufferings will seem like slight momentary afflictions in comparison to the glories that have been prepared for us.